speaking on this program is Brother Ken Willis.
Biblical perspective concerning war and peace. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 3, verse 8, a time for war and a time for peace. And, of course, we're engaged in a war. Our nation is, regardless how we feel about that war, we're engaged in a war at this time. And we looked at a couple of biblical perspectives that we need to consider in dealing that relate to the matter of war. And the first is the reality of evil. There is evil in the world. David spoke of that in Psalms 94. When David cried out, Lord, how long will the wicked, how long will the wicked triumph? And there is a kind of evil in the world that was demonstrated by King Herod, who was so power hungry that he killed members of his own family, who, when he heard that there was one who had been born king of the Jews, had little babies from 2 years old and under put to death. And Paul gave the admonition in Romans 12, verse 18, as much as it be possible, live at peace with all men. But some people are certainly not peaceable, and it's impossible to live in peace with them. Another principle that relates to war and peace is that God has given governments the responsibility for the restraint of evil in the world. In Romans 13, the first four verses, the inspired apostle points out that governments are ordained of God, and they are to be a threat to evildoers. And then a third principle we introduce today is that the concept of a just war. If we acknowledge, though, the truth that there is evil in the world that must be dealt with, and that government must play a role in seeking that justice, then we struggle with the question of whether or not this is the right time and the right way to use war for that purpose. And let me be careful to say that not all war is justifiable. David said in Psalms 120, verse 6 and verse 7, my soul has dwelt too long with one who hates peace. I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. I've heard that approximately 11% of our population is willing to go to war at any time for any reason. There are people who would be willing to blow up our enemies completely and without remorse, just wipe them off the face of the earth with an atomic bomb or something. There's a T-shirt that was seen, kill them all, God will know which are his. Well, that's never the Christian position. Christians must never speak of a holy war, even if a just war is never a holy war. War must always be the regrettable last option. And when it is decided upon, it should be seen as a tragic and an ugly necessity, and we should never glorify it. A poll taken a few weeks ago by the Pew Research Center showed that 77% of Americans believe that war is sometimes morally justified, and 12% said war was never morally justified. And there are some Americans and some Christians who believe that war is never the right thing to do. This is the pacifist position which is held by the Quakers and the Amish, among others. It's a position based on teachings of Jesus, such as the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus taught that when struck on the right cheek, we should turn the left cheek. Pacifists believe that that teaching applies not only to individual insult, but also to the attitude of nations. And the teaching of pacifism, while a respected position, has typically been a minority position, both in our country as a whole, and also as among Christians. Most would say that there are times when war is necessary, but only if it is a just war. And this is not a new concept. From the earliest times in Christian history, those who sought to follow Christ thought long and hard about the problem of war. Perhaps the first Christian thinker to write at any length about this was Augustine, who lived at the turn of the 5th century. And his theory of a just war is still used as a guide for many today. seven principles of Augustine's just war theory are summarized in this way. One, it's a war declared by government. War must be declared by a legitimate government. It's not for private individuals and groups to decide when violence must be used in support of justice. A second point is that there must be a just cause and a right intention. In other words, war cannot be waged to pump up the economy or to keep the gasoline prices low. There must be a just cause, such as self-defense, or in the face of an obvious one-sided evil. This test assumes that those who engage in the just war have righteous purposes as their motives. And then three, his point was proportionality. This is the idea of the lesser of two evils. War should not be waged unless the evils that are fought against are grave enough to justify the loss of life in the war itself. There must be reason to expect that the anticipated good results of going to war will outweigh the actual bad effects of damage done. Then his fourth point was discriminate. The war must be fought in terms of limited engagement that would forbid looting, massacre, or other engagements that would harm innocent people. And then Augustine's fifth point was the probability of success. There must be a reasonable likelihood that the war will achieve its aims. And point number six was last resort. War should not be waged unless a reasonable person would recognize the peaceful alternatives, such as diplomatic channels, economic sanctions, have been exhausted. And then last, redemptive, that is, the war must be fought in a way that leaves room for the two warring parties to reconcile when the war is over. A good example of this is the relationship that America now has with Germany and Japan. So is the war going on right now in Iraq a just war? Well, it'll be for each of us to decide, perhaps. But regardless what you decide, what can you do as a Christian? What should you do? What should I do? Let me give some practical suggestions that I believe can be very helpful as we think about this war that is going on. Now, what can we do? Number one, pray. Pray for the men and women of our armed forces, those who are and will be in the forefront of danger, for those who have already been captured and are prisoners of war. Jesus said in John 15, verse 13, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." The sacrifice of one's life is the ultimate sacrifice. And we need to be thankful for our soldiers, our men and women who are willing to do just that, so that we and our children might live our lives in freedom, and that people of Iraq might live in freedom. Pray for their safety. And also pray for the safety of innocent civilian lives. My heart breaks in hearing of so many Iraqis that don't want to fight, but are being forced to, or being killed, or being forced to fight, or seeing their children killed in front of them. Pray for those people who do not want to fight. And pray for the families of those who have already lost loved ones, Americans, British, Iraqis. Pray that a quick end might come to the conflict with a minimal loss of life. And pray for our leaders. Paul wrote, "Therefore I exhort first of all that supplications, prayers, intercessions, giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and for all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior." You can read that in 1 Timothy 2, verse 1, 2, and 3. So pray for our leaders, pray for our president, for those who advise him, that God would give them the wisdom and the courage they need to make the decisions that God would have them make, that which is ultimately the best for our nation and best for the world. And pray that God will use these anxious and uncertain times to bring many people to Christ. This is an unsettling time, a time of fear, a time when many people are realizing their need for God and the foundation of hope that only the Lord can provide. Pray for opportunities to reach out to all people, the people in the Middle East, who for the most part have only heard of Muhammad instead of hearing of Christ. And pray for people in this country, in this community. Pray for those who are Christians that they can model true peace in these troubled times, pointing the people around to Jesus at a time when hearts are touched. And also we need to pray for our enemies, just as Jesus commanded in Matthew 5. Pray for Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden. And I don't mean to pray that they meet with a quick demise. Pray that they will have a change of heart that will lead them to do what is right. And pray that they may even be led to know Jesus Christ. I know it seems absolutely impossible, but the book of Acts tells us about a man who was a political terrorist, a man by the name of Saul of Tarsus, who hated Christianity, but who was converted to Christ. He quit killing Christians and turned his life around. And I wonder how many of the early Christians had taken Jesus' advice and prayed for Saul until he became one of them. And then a second suggestion, trust God. As I listen to the news and see how we Americans have such great confidence in the Tomahawk cruise missiles and the Apache helicopters and the smart bombs and the armored tanks, I'm reminded of what David said in Psalms 20, verse 7. Some trust in chariots, some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. As Christians, we understand that our confidence is not in the military power and the strength that we have as a nation. Ultimately, our trust must be in God, and to Him we must submit our lives. We can be confident in times of war because we know that we can trust God. We may not understand all that is happening. We may not understand how God is working, but we know and we can trust God. And then the last suggestion, along with praying and trusting God, I suggest that we refuse to live in fear. Because we have a trust in God, we have nothing to be afraid of. There's a lot of anxiety in our nation about this war and about terrorism. But as Christians, we know that God is in control, and we know that all things work together according to His will for those who love God, for those who are called according to His purpose. And though war should rise against me, David said in Psalms 27:1, in this I will be confident. That was, he's going to trust in God. He said in Psalms 27:4, one thing I have desired of the Lord, that will I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. My friend, our trust must be in God. And that trust will lead to a humble obedience that will see us repenting, turning from sin, Luke 13:3, confessing Christ before men, Acts 17, verse 30, and Matthew 10, verse 32. That would have us confess that He is the Christ, have us baptized into Christ, the Prince of Peace, baptized into His death, and then seek to be at peace with all men.